You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today marks the 30-year anniversary of what some critics have called one of the most groundbreaking albums of all time. We'll talk to a music writer about the legendary hip-hop group Public Enemy and their influential album It Takes a Nation of Millions to Hold Us Back. Now, if you're someone who has trouble swallowing pills or just isn't likely to take a vitamin every day if it's a large, chalky pill, gummy vitamins might seem like a great solution. Vitamins in gummy form are showing up more and more on store shelves, and a lot of people seem to be using them. They're sweet and chewy, but are they any good for us? Becky Kirkenbush is a clinical dietitian at Watertown Regional Medical Center in Watertown. She's also a media representative for the Wisconsin Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics. Becky, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Becky, we've observed here at Central Time a lot of these gummy vitamins out here. There have been articles about them. Are people using these things more and more?
They are. About over half Americans take some type of supplement every day. Multivitamin supplements are certainly one of the more popular choices. The gummy version, I think, began being marketed towards children, but now it's certainly been increased for adults, and we see more adults choosing this version of vitamins.
And were these marketed toward kids originally, and then we saw this kind of mission creep?
Right, they were. Children have a harder time taking pills. They might be pickier with eating, so parents are trying to fill that nutritional deficiency or that void by giving them a supplement. But now adults are finding that they are enjoying these too. They're easy to take, they taste good, and they're very convenient.
What kind of range of products are out there now? What kind of supplements are in gummy form?
Basically, you can find any sort of multivitamin mineral. You can find the individual vitamins and minerals as well, too. So that could be just if you wanted just a vitamin C or you wanted a calcium. You can find those in the chew or the gummy version. So you name it, and they've been able to put it into gummy form.
Now, are these an effective way to get vitamins? To the extent that we want to take supplements at all, are there advantages or disadvantages to gummy vitamins?
Sure. Well, I always advocate for getting your complete nutrition through food first, but that's not something that, you know, all people can do for various reasons. So, you know, gummy versions, certainly they taste better. They come in different flavors like fruit, mint, chocolate. And they're great for those who have difficulty swallowing pills and tablets. Some people take so many medications that they go through what we call pill fatigue. So it's easier for them to think about chewing on a gummy vitamin versus taking one more tablet or pill. They can be more quickly absorbed than pills because you chew them before they're digested. So there are some definite positives. Some of the cons to taking them would be that they do cost more than the pill form. And then you do have to be aware that they have a higher sugar content. So there's about 1 to 3 grams of sugar for 2 gummies, and usually a gummy supplement requires 2 gummies as a serving. So if you're consuming it in the recommended amount, that's not a big amount of sugar to take in, but you do then have to realize that it's better to take that and then brush your teeth and floss because you still have the risk for tooth decay, bacteria growth, and plaque. So we do want people to be aware of that. Some of the gummy vitamins, because of the great taste, we do fear that children may view them as candy. So we do want parents to be aware of that so that there is not overconsumption, which could potentially be toxic. We recommend storing the gummy vitamins in an area that's out of reach for small children.
Talking to Becky Kirkenbush, clinical dietitian at Watertown Regional Medical Center, talking about the rise of gummy vitamins and whether they're an effective way to get your nutrition. And Becky, I want to talk about that last point you made a little bit more. I think it's easy for kids or grown-ups to think, well, if a little bit of vitamins is good for me, a lot is better. If these are like candy, I might start eating them like candy. What are some vitamins we have to be careful because you really can get too much of a good thing?
Right. So there are vitamins which are called fat-soluble vitamins. Vitamin A, D, E, and K. So those are vitamins that are not easily excreted out of the body. They are stored in the body and stored with fat. So those are the ones we're most concerned about overdoing or building up and becoming toxic. Some of of the other vitamins, which we are water-soluble vitamins, we can excrete, but the fat-soluble vitamins are not that way.
Now, we started off, of course, talking about these gummy vitamins, but you were saying earlier, plan A, your first choice for people is to get as much nutrition as they can from the food they eat. What are some things that are you recommend people that are easy to add to the diet that might be covering some of these vitamins that they might want to cover in supplements instead?
Sure. So I know that people take calcium supplements. So good sources of calcium would be if you like yogurt or milk or cheese. Other people, they take vitamin C supplements. So you can get vitamin C certainly in your fruits, especially your citrus fruits, but also in some of your vegetables like broccoli and sweet potatoes, which most people don't think about. So your fruits and vegetables will have a lot of the vitamins and minerals that that people seem to supplement with a multivitamin. Most Americans just don't eat enough fruits and vegetables, the recommended servings, and so that's why they seem to be lacking in those nutrients.
That's easy to add a vitamin, gummy or otherwise, to our
right.
daily routine, morning or night or whatever. Do you kind of help people add those beneficial fruits and vegetables to their daily routine, their lifestyle?
Right. We go over what we call the My Plate, which is the five food groups. We try to get a diet recall, see which foods are they lacking in or where can we add foods. If they're not eating a fruit at breakfast, is there some way that we can add something like berries to their cereal? If they're not having a vegetable at lunch or dinner, is there something that they might enjoy, like a side salad or adding some vegetables to a sandwich? So I always say food first, and then if we need supplements, we can certainly do that.
And in your practice, is there something a lot of us are just doing wrong that you're consistently worried about for the patients you see?
What I see is there's a fear of food. People seem to vilify one specific food or one specific food group, where people will tell me that they can't eat carbohydrates, or they have to stay away from anything that is white, or they can't have bread or potatoes. And that's not accurate. So I try to encourage people to look at the whole picture, look at your diet as a whole, and not just be siloed with one particular food or food group. Because if you start excluding those, it can build up, and then you're going to be missing out on certain nutrients the more you exclude.
We'll leave it there. Becky, thanks so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
Been talking to Becky Kirkenbush, clinical dietitian at Watertown Regional Medical Center and a media representative for the Wisconsin Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics. She joined us today to talk about the gummy vitamin trend. You may have seen it on store shelves, maybe even on your household shelves, whether or not they still provide nutritional value. The verdict, yeah, watch the sugar, but eat better food too. 30 years ago today, the hip-hop group Public Enemy released the album It Takes a Nation of Millions to Hold Us Back, and at the time, hip-hop was still often on the fringes of the mainstream music industry. Today, the album is regarded by some critics as one of the most influential of all time, and its experimental production and social-political themes continue to resonate with listeners and inspire artists today. For more on the groundbreaking album, we talked to Ernesto Aguilar, a freelance writer, membership program director for the National Federation of Community Broadcasters, and a music writer. We'll hear from Ernesto Aguilar after a bit from Public Enemy's frontman, Chuck D.
Our first tour was the Beastie Boys already having 20,000 people in front of them, and Public Enemy's going to open up with a large logo, sirens, two brothers on top of stanchions with Uzis, and we're coming out looking like we're out of the Black Panthers and Nation of Islam, and we don't give a damn what you white folks think. This is the truth, and let the truth shall set you free.
Freedom is a road seldom traveled by the multitude.
Public Enemy number one.
Show what you got.
Well, set the stage for us before this album comes out. What was the rap scene like?
1980s hip-hop is probably not far from the mainstream rap that you're hearing right now. These were not the most complex songs, and the lyrics were pretty commonplace. Having fun, pursuing dates, being great, being rich, or both was pretty much the footprint. Now, 1988 was the year that the actor Will Smith broke into the pop music scene in March as the Fresh Prince with the song Parents Just Don't Understand.
You know, parents are the same, no matter time, no place. They don't understand that us kids are going to make some mistakes. So to you other kids all across the land, there's no need to argue. Parents just don't understand.
A Nation of Millions wasn't Public Enemy's first album. Where were they at this point before they sat down to put out this album?
Now, Public Enemy was introduced to the world with its 1987 debut album, Yo Bum Rush the Show. The story for that record has seen some remarkable revisionism in a lot of respects. The New York Times and a few others hailed that record as a powerful political statement, but absolutely, there were some strong messages, but the album tipped to pretty much being your typical late 80s party record.
You got to raise the roof because it's all on fire. Not done by the sun or electrical wire. Not done by the sun striking matches with daughters, but done by scratching, so save that water. This damn is packed, so
it was also not a big sales-shattering release. It did not chart particularly well, and so Public Enemy came out of 1987 regarded as a promising young band, but virtually nobody predicted that they'd vault into the stratosphere the way that they did. First, it was Chuck D's baritone. His rhyme style changed between show and nation from more of a vibe popular in the 80s to more of the insistent style that we have come to be used to. And then there was the production. There were pop, jazz, and soul influences and complicated samples there. But what the Bomb Squad provided was considerably denser and more aligned on funk and rock.
Yeah, this was a very new and different. It was this wall of sounds that when I heard it was different than anything I'd heard before. Did everybody, even everybody within Public Enemy, like this new heavily layered sound?
It's funny. Chuck D has often been quoted that he hated the record Don't Believe the Hype, one of their biggest records, and certainly one that is iconic to them, because didn't really like the sound, thought it was a little bit odd, and just didn't really fit with them. And certainly if you listen to Show and listen to Nation, they sound completely different.
Here's what I want you all to do for me. Bang! What you're looking for, the same thing. It's a new thing. Check out this, I bring a old and roll below the level, cause I'm living low next to the base.
Come on!
Turn up the radio. They're claiming I'm a criminal.
But Nation is why Public Enemy is compared to the Sex Pistols and the Clash now. This record was shocking to a lot of people. Show was looked at for some of its social consciousness, but Nation was really a manifesto. It did not speak or sound like anything else back then, and certainly not like its previous release.
I'm the epitome of Public Enemy. Used, abused without clues. I refuse to blow a fuse. They even had it on the news.
Don't believe the hype. Don't believe the hype.
And it accomplished something that you don't see in pop culture very often, really once in a generation or two. Music that's uncompromisingly political, but captures the attention of the mainstream because it was fun to listen to. It was different. Music scholars can delve into how it treated sampling, Chuck's new, more urgent flow, and the arrangement of the album overall. However, nothing in rap before or since had made the splash that Nation did because it was so accessible to the mainstream.
Our team put together a clip of how Public Enemy sampled other artists to help lay the backbone for these tracks. We're going to listen now. You'll hear a snippet of Madison's own, the late Clyde Stubblefield, drumming on James Brown's Funky Drummer. Then over the top, we'll hear a saxophone line from a song called The Grunt by the same band. And then you'll hear how Public Enemy put it all together for the track Rebel Without a Pause. Here's a listen.
One, two, three, four, get it!
So take that apart for us a little bit. Clyde Stubblefield, we talked to him before he passed away about the Funky Drummer, I think the most sampled drum track in human history, I think. Talk about how it all comes together.
The fascinating thing about Rebel Without a Pause to me is how the producers took Funky Drummer, what's become, as you pointed out, one of rap's best known samples, and they could have easily left it right there. There are literally dozens of hip hop songs they've used Funky Drummer and Funky Drummer alone, and that's been just fine, and they've made hits out of those songs. However, what was so interesting about this is the Bomb Squad interspersed it with another song, as you mentioned, and three other songs that make Rebel Without a Pause. You can hear within their Chub Rock, Joski Love, and the Soul Children in parts of that song, and they create a different experience, not the usual, oh, I recognize that sample, which many of us have had when we listen to hip hop, but instead have created an independent composition altogether. And you can hear that in a lot of different cuts within this record. You think of a lesser known song like Party for Your Right to Fight on the album, which is when you listen to it, it's a fairly simple track. It's basically Chuck and Flavor reading the same script, but the song actually includes samples from Sly and the Family Stone, Bob Marley, the Beastie Boys, James Brown, Bobby Bird, Funkadelic, and a speech by Malcolm X. So you get this complex thing that really stands out and makes it so outstanding.
We're talking to Ernesto Aguilar, freelance writer, membership program director for the National Federation of Community Broadcasters. It's the 30th anniversary of the Public Enemy album, It Takes a Nation of Millions to Hold Us Back. Let's start talking about the influence of this now. It inspired a lot of people, but also the Bomb Squad, the production team, went on to produce a lot of other big releases, not, I think, just by Public Enemy. Can you talk about what they went on to do?
Yeah, absolutely. Now, of course, pop music is about being popular, and the Bomb Squad created something unprecedented with Nation, and most assuredly, there were musicians that wanted that touch in hopes that they could rock it to fame. But what sometimes is lost, I think, in that equation is the moment that Nation came. At a time of tensions in New York, there was the police killing of the graffiti artist Michael Stewart, race riots, and more. And indeed, there were issues everywhere. And Chuck's voice was one that demanded attention.
We wanted to destroy all barriers set up for music. And Brain of Noise, we thought, was the first statement that actually said, you treat us like you know, but you know, we're music too.
It had an energy and tapped into a cultural flashpoint that was almost impossible to repeat. Regardless, the Bomb Squad produced some groundbreaking records. They worked with Vanessa Williams, LL Cool J, Ziggy Marley, Belle Biv DeVoe, Eric B. and Rakim, the Manic Street Preachers, Run DMC. They produced Ice Cube's solo album from N.W.A., and they also maintained the Public Enemy relationship onward, producing Fear of a Black Planet, Apocalypse 91, and more of their lesser-known records.
You use the phrase, talk about Chuck D's voice, demanded attention. And I think that with this album, the voice, Flavor Flav, the production, this is not an album you play in the background and ignore.
Yeah, absolutely not. What's interesting to me is how this emboldened a lot of performers. Sales didn't hurt. Nation moved about 500,000 units in its first month and went platinum within the year, which was outstanding for a hip-hop release at the time. But Chuck had a way of demanding attention with the cadence that he hit.
Never batted and batted because the brother is madder than mad at the fact that's corrupt like a senator. Soul on the road, but you treat it like soap on the rope because the beats and the lines are so dope. Listen for lessons I'm saying inside music that the critics are blasting me for. They'll never care for the brothers.
This kind of style where his baritone was put with a lot more emphasis on particular words brought out the music and really matched the production in a way that was completely unique for the period and really sent shockwaves through a lot of hip-hop.
How did the rap world react to the politics being so front and center on this album? Did it encourage other people to follow suit?
I think a lot of what emboldened so many individuals was the fact that this record was so successful. I suggest a group like NWA, which was validly political from the start, gained far more notoriety and fame in part thanks to Public Enemy's ability to show that there was an assertive buying public that was interested in how African Americans viewed the state of the world. That effort by Public Enemy really reshaped how labels saw this music and also how the public saw it, and in turn emboldened artists to step out a bit more than they may have otherwise.
Let's look back from our vantage point now, 30 years later. Some albums don't hold up 3 decades later, even if they were big, even if they were influential at the time. Is this still A Nation of Millions? Is this still an album worth going back and listening to?
Nation of Millions really does stand out in a lot of ways for both its production values as well as its lyrical content. If you can look at the headlines today, we see racial conflict still remains a relevant conversation. Many of the issues that Public Enemy brought forward to the mainstream was completely atypical for that period, and also was something that still remains crucial for people to understand today. I think that there is still quite a great deal for people who listen to Eight Takes a Nation of Millions to hold us back, both with an appreciation for the sound of it as well as its importance and significance politically as a record.
Ernesto, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Absolutely.
Ernesto Aguilar is a music writer and membership program director for the National Federation of Community Broadcasters. He joined us to talk about the influential Public Enemy album, It Takes a Nation of Millions to Hold Us Back. That was released exactly 30 years ago today. Construction on the massive Foxconn campus is officially underway. President Trump led today's groundbreaking ceremony in Racine County. He was joined by Governor Walker, House Speaker Paul Ryan, Foxconn CEO Terry Goh, and other leaders. The company has promised to invest up to $10 billion and employ 13,000 people. If it delivers on that pledge, it will get up to $4 billion in taxpayer incentives from state and local governments. The president says the Foxconn deal is a proof that his policy is revitalizing the manufacturing sector.
When you look at what we're doing, it's very simple. It's called Keep America Great. We'll get you nice hats. Maybe we'll make them green this time instead of red. Green, representing cash. This plant will manufacture state-of-the-art LCDs, adding an average of $3.4 billion to the state's economy every single year.
According to our next guest, Wisconsin's investment in Foxconn has already been paying off, and not just in the southeastern part of the state. Mark Hogan is Secretary and CEO of the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation. He also attended today's groundbreaking ceremony. Secretary Hogan, welcome to Central Time.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Well, before we get into the economic impact, how does it feel to have this project, it's been a long time in the making, have ground broken there?
Well, we actually started breaking ground over a month ago. This was the formal groundbreaking.
Right.
It certainly is the culmination of a great effort on a lot of different people at the local level, the state level, of putting all the pieces in place, working with the company and working through with the federal government as well to get some of these things in place. It really, when we think about how much we have done and how much we have accomplished since April 28th of last year, it's pretty impressive, but it's mind-boggling at the same time.
This week, you wrote a column that ran in newspapers around the state. You say Wisconsin has been already benefiting from Foxconn's investment. How is that playing out?
Well, in the whole concept behind what Foxconn wants to do, two things. One is it's about Wisconsin first. From a labor standpoint, from a supply chain standpoint, to the extent that they're able to utilize the resources that we have in the state, that's part of it. A second part of it is the partnerships that they're forming, whether it's with the UW system or our technical colleges, that's forming. They've signed two contracts now for work. The first $100 million is for the grading project. There are 27 companies. All but one are from the state of Wisconsin. Within that first contract, which was $100 million, the calculation is that 60 of the 72 counties will have employees, either the direct or indirect employees, will be coming from 60 of our 72 counties in the state. So, you know, the we really are pushing the Wisconsin First message. The company has been on board with that from day one.
And talk a little more. There's some skepticism in recent polls from people outside of the southeastern Wisconsin. People worried, like, hey, great, lovely for you down there. It's not really going to help us. Talk a little more about how you see this playing out and helping people outside of the immediate region.
Well, we'll continue to work with the company to identify supply chain partners in the northern part of the state, outside of southeastern Wisconsin. Again, they have expressed a great interest in being able to do that. I think that you will see they will be building, they will be creating hubs in a couple of other communities. Terry Goh will be in Green Bay tomorrow making an announcement with Governor Walker about something they'll be doing up there. And so that's the whole concept. We certainly get the idea that we don't want it to be just about Racine County or southeastern Wisconsin. We want this to benefit everybody in the state, and both the state at the local level, the contractors, the company especially. It is about Wisconsin First and the entire state of Wisconsin, not just southeastern Wisconsin.
Talking to Mark Hogan, Secretary and CEO of the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation, about today's groundbreaking of the Foxconn campus in Racine County. Secretary Hogan, people look at this price tag for the state, $3 billion in incentives from the state, another close to $900 million, I think, from local incentives. Even if it's a lot of jobs, is this a gamble for the state when we're talking about that kind of money?
I wouldn't say it's a gamble from the state perspective. Our contract is for $2.85 billion. $1.5 billion is directly related to jobs. $1.35 billion is directly related to the capital expenditures. And they have to have minimum number of jobs in order to qualify to get those incentives, both for the jobs themselves but and the wages, but also for the capital expenditures. So I feel we feel like we have a really good contract with the company. It does put the pressure on them to hire the people to invest in the capital and get this project moving if they want to earn the full amount. So I'm not concerned about it. We spent an awful lot of time negotiating the contract, and I feel good about where we are today.
Talk about kind of multiplier effects that you're hoping for. There will be the direct jobs themselves. You mentioned the construction work. What other kind of spillover effects are you hoping to see?
Yeah, the construction jobs, there'll be up somewhere close to 10,000 jobs that will work on it. I don't know what the number of hours are, but the contractors talk about the total number of hours. This is going to be a 4 to 6 year build out, because as they build this ecosystem, technology is generally going to change probably over that period of time, so they need to be flexible to be able to do that. But on the direct basis, when they're employing 13,000, the studies that we have just on manufacturing in Wisconsin, in the Midwest, you can count on a multiplier effect of anywhere from 2 to 2.5 times the number of indirect and induced jobs that are created based on the 13,000 direct jobs. So we feel that the total number, that next level of jobs will be in the 20 to 25,000 jobs.
One concern that some critics have raised is that Foxconn has done things that look promising in other communities and other states, other countries around the world, and things didn't pan out. Their interest moved on to other projects and places. Is that a worry for you? Is that something that keeps you up at night?
Not at all. I've been involved in this since April 28th of last year, and every step of the way, this company has shown a commitment to be in Wisconsin. Once they made that decision and we announced it the end of last July, they have been full steam ahead on becoming a partner with the state, with the region. I have no concern about that whatsoever.
And we see in the news today, it looks like the first factories are going to be producing a different kind of screen than had been talked about previously. At least the early projects might employ fewer people than originally planned. What's your read on that story?
Well, on the job side, again, we have a minimum number of jobs. It gradually builds up. Basically, the minimum is 5,000 jobs by year 5, 10,000 by year 10, and that's the minimum side. And then they can earn up to the 13,000 in the later years. They can earn subsidies on those wages. one of the key reasons that we partnered with Foxconn is the fact that for over 40 years, this company has been a leader in technology. They have led the changes that are, from a technology standpoint, on a worldwide basis. They're one of the top five technology companies in the world. Our full expectation would be that they'll continue to run their company in what they believe to be in their best interest relative to their shareholders, and they'll do that here. So if they look at it and at some point down the line, and if they think that they should be doing something other than what they had talked about doing before, I don't think it's government's responsibility to get in the way of them making that decision. Again, the key points to our investment are 13,000 jobs, a $10 billion investment, and an average salary of just under $54,000. That's how they earn the credits from WEDC.
I want to talk about job training. Do we have the skilled employees in Wisconsin, and how will the state, the technical colleges, and Foxconn work to make sure we do?
Yeah, I think through the end of this biennial budget, the state will have spent about $350 million on workforce training. And I go back to Governor Walker's budget address in February of 2017, before Foxconn was even there, and before we even knew about Foxconn. And he was talking about the fact that economic development equals workforce development. And the states that solve the workforce problem are going to be the most successful from an economic development standpoint. So we have been working all alongside with the UW system, with the private colleges, with the technical colleges throughout. I mean, this is something that has been going on for a long time, where the tech colleges, for example, are working with the employers in their area to make sure that the students that they have are going through the curriculum that's required to be employed by the employers in their area. So this isn't something new to Wisconsin. We just think that we've put more money into it. And then all of a sudden Foxconn came along, and we actually view it as a catalyst. And if you talk to academic partners, there have been a lot more conversations between various academic institutions than there ever have been before. We think that's a real positive, because in the end, we're trying to solve not just Foxconn's 13,000 jobs, but there are a lot of companies. Every company in the state is looking for employees, and we want to be able to fulfill those needs as well.
Talking to Mark Hogan, Secretary and CEO of the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation. He attended today's official groundbreaking for the Foxconn campus in Racine County. Talked to him about the project's economic potential for the region and the state. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think Foxconn will be an economic winner or loser for the state? Do you think the state's incentives are the right amount to pay given the jobs on the line here? If you live in the area, what are you looking for in your community? Are you hoping to work for Foxconn yourself? Are you already? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about the Foxconn plant in Racine County. President Trump was at the site in Mount Pleasant today for the official groundbreaking ceremony. The secretary and CEO of the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation is with us. Mark Hogan was there for that groundbreaking. He says Wisconsin is already feeling some benefits from the deal. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions for our guest and your thoughts on the future of the Foxconn plant. Do you think it's a good thing for the state's economy? Are you hopeful that it's going to drive jobs in technology, construction, and more for the state? Do you have worries you want to talk about? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@wpr.org. Before we go to our caller, Secretary Hogan, another issue came up at the groundbreaking today. President Trump has been criticizing Harley-Davidson after they announced their plans to move some production to the European Union because of tariffs and the back-and-forth tariff war. Here's the president talking about that today.
Harley-Davidson, please build those beautiful motorcycles in the USA, please, okay? Don't get cute with us. Don't get cute.
That was actually from a fundraiser today in Milwaukee, not the groundbreaking itself. Your thoughts, Secretary Hogan, are you worried about what you might see from Harley-Davidson in the midst of this tariff battle?
Well, we're concerned about how they impact any of the companies in the state, and clearly Harley-Davidson is one of our iconic names. And, you know, Governor Walker has been very clear with President Trump and also Vice President Pence. He's got a very good dialogue going with them. And one of the advantages with that dialogue is he's able to make specific instances on companies like a Harley-Davidson, which will be impacted by tariffs and free trade, or by tariffs. And we just think that the best way to go, Governor Walker's position and our position, is that free trade is really the best thing. Let's open the doors. Let everybody be on the same playing field. The challenge is always, how do you get to that point? And I think any presidential administration has had an issue as to how do you get to that point. President Trump has his method, but again, we're communicating about the impact that it has, not just on the manufacturers in the state, but also on our dairy farmers that are impacted by it as well.
Let's go to our callers about Foxconn now at 800-642-1234. Terry is with us in Green Bay. Terry, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. This is a boondoggle, and I'm going to tell you this, is that the secretary there is going to be out of a job come November when Democrats take over the gubernatorialship here in the governor's office and also the House and Senate, because this is ridiculous. The WEDEC Corporation is going to be basically greenlighting the tax credits that are going to be going to the contract here, and we need to go through the contract with a fine-tooth comb, because I think in the end, Foxconn is not going to earn its potential when it comes to the billions of dollars that have been set aside for this. Now, I hope this project is a success down the road, but this is a boondoggle for taxpayers. 25 years to pay it back off, that's ridiculous.
And Terry, thanks for the call. I want to jump in. There's a lot there. Mark, a long time, first of all, for this to get paid off to taxpayers, Terry says.
Yeah, I think the Fiscal Bureau did their analysis, and it did not look at it. Looked at the economic impact that was provided, which included indirect and induced jobs. But it does not take into consideration the things that, they're buying the 611 building in downtown Milwaukee for their corporate headquarters. They'll be making an announcement about an additional building that they'll be purchasing in another area of the state. It doesn't take into consideration the $1 million investment that the company is making with the private and public colleges and technical schools in the state relative to a smart city, smart future competition. So these are all things that when you do the analysis, you can't take full, you can't really incorporate those into, Terry's got his opinion. I don't agree with it at all. We've had studies that have been done that anywhere between 40, this will add anywhere between $39 to $51 billion to the state's GDP over the next 15 years. And in doing that on the high end, that's $18 return for every dollar of state investment. I think that's a pretty good investment on the part of the state.
And Terry mentioned the possibility that a Democratic governor and or legislature, if that happened in November, could change the deal. Is that something that you worry about, political instability and how it might affect all of this?
No. I mean, we have a contract. The contract is with the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation. And unless the company were to come in and have an amendment done or open the door that way, we have a contract, and it's a 15-year contract, and it says if they employ these people, we will pay them the money. If they don't employ the people, if they don't spend the capital, and they're not hitting the minimum number of jobs and the minimum amount of wages, then we don't pay them anything. So our risk is a future risk, and it's based all on their performance.
Thanks for the call, Terry. We're talking to Mark Hogan, Secretary and CEO of the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation, talking about the Foxconn project, official groundbreaking earlier today. Back to your calls now. Shirley is on the line in Madison. Shirley, hi.
Hello. Hello.
Hi. What did you want to bring up, Shirley?
Well, I live in Madison, and just outside of Madison in the city of Verona is a company called Epic. And we have never given them a dollar of our taxpayer money. And that company has turned around and pumped millions of dollars into our industry here. I think Foxconn is a big con.
Shirley, thanks for the call. Mark, Shirley saying we can have successful businesses without this kind of incentive package.
You can. And Epic is a tremendous company. They've grown to, I believe, over 10,000 employees over a long period of time. But what we're talking about is taking an industry that has never existed in outside of Asia and putting that industry in a 4 to 5 year period of time into the state of Wisconsin, and all of the supply chain opportunities and the employment opportunities that go beyond that. So, yes, Epic is terrific. There are a lot of terrific companies that have been built over a long period of time, but this opportunity is so unique to have an industry come to the United States, come to Wisconsin. It's one that we just think, in the long run, it'll be a tremendous winner for the state because of the transformational nature of it.
Shirley, thanks for that call. Secretary Hogan, can you paint a picture of, say, looking back 10 years from now, what does success look like with the Foxconn project for Wisconsin?
I think it's that the company is living up to what they said they were going to do. They're employing the number of employees that they've had. They've spent the money. The ecosystem around that, and keep in mind too, Rob, that the ecosystem that is part of this industry, a lot of that ecosystem is a lot of those supply chain. They're not here yet. They're not in Wisconsin because the industry is not in the United States. It's not in Wisconsin. So we'll see that ecosystem building up over a period of time. We will see the transformational nature of it from an academic standpoint with the academic partners. And we just think that in the long run, we're giving the young people of today a reason to have a family-supporting job, a career here in Wisconsin that otherwise, you know, there's a lot of great opportunities in the state right now. This will just be one more of those great opportunities.
And briefly, what are the first couple steps now after this official groundbreaking?
Well, they're moving dirt already. As I said, they broke ground about 6 weeks ago. They're moving the dirt. That's a big process. They just put out bids for a multi-purpose building that they'll be putting on one end of the property. And that will really house some of the administrative staff, but also the contractors that will be working there. It'll be office space for them. And then they'll start working on the fab.
We'll leave it there. Secretary Hogan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. Appreciate the time.
That's Mark Hogan, Secretary and CEO of the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation. We talked with him about today's groundbreaking for the Foxconn facility in Racine County and the economic benefits he says it's already bringing the state.